says we shouldn't do that dramatically.
Always good to wake up everyone. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, the date is January 26, 2012. I've been told it's the governor's birthday today, and it's also my father's birthday, so maybe they can get that free birthday dinner together at the local Applebee's or something. But Senate File 1240 is what we're going to begin with today, and that would be Senator Thompson. Welcome to the committee, Senator Thompson. Your bill is in regards to criminal forfeiture provisions and modifications.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Good to be here today. And in a way, it feels like a long time ago, and in a way, it feels like we never left. I guess that's the nature of business, isn't it? Well, we are here to discuss forfeitures today. And specifically, what we're doing is we are taking some reforms that in 2010 passed as they pertain to controlled substances. And we are now going to apply them to DWIs and other crimes. And, Mr. Chairman and members, just by way of explanation, we have kind of a two-track system when we're talking about forfeiture of property. There's oftentimes a criminal case going along with a civil case. And forfeiture tends to fall on the civil track. So when you have a civil forfeiture case, and when we talk about forfeiture, we're talking about your property being confiscated, whether it's an automobile or a boat or some other kind of personal property. That's the kind of thing we're talking about when we talk forfeiture, and obviously we need the government to be able to do that in the case of certain crimes and activities. By the same token, we obviously want to make sure that civil liberties are protected and that innocent people don't lose their property improperly and or have an inability to get it back. So what we're really doing is just changing some rules on DWIs and other crimes to correspond with what was done in 2010 on controlled substances. And first off, I want to make sure that I get my legislation into the form that we want it. And so there actually was another file involved in this, a Senate file number 1239, that we are now going to be merging into 1240. And make it all one bill. And so I would offer up the A7 amendment to get the bill in the form that the author would prefer. At this time, I'd offer the A7 amendment. All it does is merge Senate File 1239 into 40. So I would ask at this time I would move the A7 amendment.
Senator Thompson, this is the first bill hearing you've had?
Yes.
On this particular bill? This is original jurisdiction, so the A7 amendment will be considered an author's amendment. And let the record reflect that a quorum is present. Senator Thompson renews his motion that the A7 amendment be moved and adopted into the Senate File 1240. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is one small change that is made also by the A7 amendment, and this is the result of a discussion that took place very near the end of the last session, and that is as it pertains to putting individuals on notice of their rights. If the members want to direct their attention to a couple of places on the A7 amendment, first, lines 1.9 through 1.11, and then also on page 3, that would be lines 3.13 through 3.15. And the change that was made there is a member had some concern about requiring notice to be made in a certain number of different languages, and so we've simply changed this provision so that notice would be given in English, obviously, and then any individual jurisdiction in an effort to work with the particular population within that area is free to go ahead and provide notice in other languages in addition to English. So that change was made to accommodate a member's concern, and I believe that the various constituent groups involved in this all agreed with that, and that there was no controversy over this particular change. All right, now to the substance of the bill. What we have tried to do, and forfeiture is an extremely complicated area of the law, and I don't pretend to have any high level of expertise in it. As I said, it's a matter of the government's ability to take a citizen's property, usually in conjunction with a criminal case, and that's what we're dealing with here. Now, what we're trying to prevent is that an individual can lose his or her property and not have a reasonable method to get that property back in the event that they end up to be rightly entitled to it. So if you have a criminal case juxtaposed over a civil case, the civil forfeiture, so you've got, say, for example, a DWI claim or a claim that someone is carrying stolen merchandise or whatever the case may be, they are stopped by the authorities, the police, highway patrol, whatever it might be, and they are charged with a specific crime. There may be property that is held by the government. The way the current system works for everything except in controlled substances cases is that it is entirely possible that your time may run out to try to challenge to get your property back before the criminal case is heard. So let me just try to give you a real-world example that I think drives the point home. We all remember the O.J. Simpson case, where he, of course, was charged with murder and was charged with murdering his ex-wife and was ultimately acquitted and found not guilty in the criminal case. But in a subsequent civil case, the families of the survivors were able to get a finding of liability against O.J. Simpson. So you see there are two different standards that apply. We all know that in a criminal case, the standard of proof is guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. In the vast majority of civil cases, the standard of proof is preponderance of the evidence. So even though to people who don't want to do crazy things in life, like sit on a judiciary committee, it seems kind of goofy that could happen as a practical matter, since the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt is so much higher than preponderance of the evidence, it is really not illogical to be found not guilty in a criminal case and yet be found liable in a civil case. So what literally could have happened or could happen under today's law that we're trying to correct here today is that an individual could be stopped and charged with a crime, and they then have to bring a case to try to get their property back, but their right to do that may run out before their criminal case is tried. So they may go on and be found not guilty in the criminal case, or it's even possible that a prosecutor would determine there was insufficient evidence to even bring charges, and yet it is literally too late to get their personal property back. And in fact, one strong disincentive to moving forward in the civil case is if you bring a claim against the government to get your property back, in a civil case, discovery would start. There could be an exchange of written documents, interrogatories. There could theoretically be depositions. And you may have to disclose things that could work against your interest in the criminal case. So the bottom line is a person really is in an absolute catch-22. The timeline may run out before the criminal case for them to get their property back, and yet if they undertake the process to get their property back, they may be compromising their defense in the criminal case. Now, in a state and a nation that upholds the sanctity of civil liberties, that just isn't right. So what this bill does primarily, and again, this is only addressing one small issue in this large area of forfeiture, but what we're doing is we are staying the civil case so that if you want to try to get your property back, if it's been taken from you by the government, you do not have to institute that proceeding until after the criminal case has been disposed of. So that if you are found not guilty, or if the prosecutor determines that there is insufficient evidence to even charge you, you then will have the opportunity to get your property back. And, of course, as a practical matter, we would like to think that in the vast majority of cases, if an individual is acquitted or perhaps pleads down to a lesser charge that's not related to the felony, or whatever the case may be, if the criminal charge, to put it in layman's terms, doesn't stick, that in all likelihood the governmental authority would just return the individual's property to them without that individual even having to undergo the cost and the process to try to get it back. So, trying to summarize, we currently have a system where individuals lose their property and don't have a realistic opportunity to try to get it back until their criminal case has been tried and/or disposed of in some other way, in which case they may not have the opportunity to get it back. That doesn't seem to be consistent with the way our system should operate. We want to change the law to be consistent with how we treat controlled substance cases, that you can go through the criminal process, you can be acquitted, the charges aren't brought, whatever the case may be. You are allowed to go free as a citizen, and you then still have the opportunity to get your property back. And it really is no more complicated than that. So, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to take questions that the members may have. I will not be able to answer them. I'll just point. But I'd be happy to take the questions. Otherwise, I've got a couple of gentlemen here that are willing to weigh in on this as well. And I would like to point out for the members that this is a bipartisan piece of legislation. Senator Latz was good enough to sign on to this. I appreciate that, Senator Latz. And also, I believe that Senator Harrington joined in this legislation as well. And I believe that all of the various interest groups that have concern about this, from the prosecutors to the criminal defense lawyers, are on board as well. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll take questions.
Okay. Any questions? You might get off cheap today, Senator Thompson.
I hope you don't get what you pay for.
If there's no questions, we can move the bill.
All right. Did you have anything you felt you needed to add? All right. In light of that, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1240 be adopted and as amended. And I don't know if we need to make another committee stop or not. Are we referring this to another committee or right to the floor?
To the floor.
This will go to the floor. There,
Senator Thompson renews his motion that Senate File 1240 as adopted be recommended to pass and be moved to the floor. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
Chairman.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Senator.
And Senator Newman, Senate File 654. Welcome to the committee, Senator Newman. Is it my understanding that you're introducing Senate File 654, but it will be, if passed, it would be considered an amendment to be later added to the next bill, House File 382, a Thompson bill?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Please proceed, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Senate File 654 is a bill regarding an issue that has been brought forward by the Minnesota State Bar Association. It is, in my estimation, it's a technical type of a bill in that the issues that are to be addressed would be number one, under this legislation, how to treat disclaimers as they are affected by the federal estate and gift tax matters under the Internal Revenue Code. Second, it makes it clear that a disclaimer of an interest in real property is effective upon the filing of a document with the county recorder or the registrar of titles. And third, it clears up an ambiguity regarding the ability to disclaim partial interest, particularly insofar as those interests come out of trust. That, in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman and members, are the critical parts of this bill, and it would be our intention then to amend at the appropriate time this bill onto the next bill that Senator Thompson is bringing up. If there is anyone that has any particular questions with respect to this bill, I do have with me Mr. Peter Hattinen and Mr. Drew Basie. Both are attorneys and members of the probate section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, and they are prepared to field any questions that you may pose.
Okay. Senator Newman, I was having trouble finding Senate File 654 in our packets, and for all purposes, the A1 amendment that's in our packets is a duplicate of Senate File 654. But I'm going to have counsel explain the technical aspect of this so we're knowing exactly what we're supposed to file.
Mr. Chairman, members, if you look in your packet, you've got that A-1 amendment for House File 382, and the new Article 4 is verbatim the language from Senator Newman's bill.
Does everyone track with that? Please proceed. Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, I have nothing further unless members have questions.
Okay. Are there any questions at this time for Senator Newman? Senator Newman, you have two gentlemen at the table. Did they want to testify at this time?
If I'm not sure if they want to add anything. If you do, please identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Peter Hattinen, and I'm a lawyer at Frederickson & Byron in Minneapolis. I'm here in my capacity as co-chair of the Probate and Trust Law Section's Legislation Committee. As the senator has said, this is a technical amendment to the disclaimer statute. We made a global amendment in 2010 to reflect changes in the Uniform Disclaimer Act, which reflected a philosophy that a disclaimer could be effective for state purposes but not effective for federal transfer tax purposes. Since that amendment, things have been running smoothly, except that a dispute arose between two district courts regarding the disclaimer of an interest that had been held in a trust and distributed to a beneficiary. We thought we had made it clear that while that may not be disclaimed for federal transfer tax purposes, the beneficiary could disclaim that distribution for Minnesota purposes. And indeed, that dispute was resolved by an appellate court decision in late 2011. And you'll see that we codified that new common law in Section 524.2-1106, the underlined language there just codifies the appellate court's decision. That's the bulk of what this amendment does. The other amendments are very technical, primarily reflecting the fact that the real estate section asked us to make it clear that a disclaimer of an interest in real property isn't effective until it's been recorded rather than simply filed.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifier?
Mr. Chairman, I would assume that we will just, in effect, lay this on the table until the next bill comes up. Am I correct?
Yes. Senator Newman, Senate File 654 is laid over. Then we'll bring it up again on Senator Thompson's bill presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Thompson. House File 382 regarding receivership and assignments for the benefit of creditors. Welcome back to the committee, Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are talking now about an area of the law that is not well known by a lot of people. It's a little bit odd, the law of receiverships. And receiverships are typically used in business disputes, real estate disputes, could be family disputes, and it's essentially a process by which a court orders a receiver, someone called a receiver, to take custodial responsibility for a business or an asset or something along those lines. And there are a number of reasons that that could happen. For example, a creditor may have the right to drive a business into receivership in the event of default on a note. Commercial real estate may be put into a receivership if there is a dispute over something to make sure that the real estate doesn't deteriorate from lack of upkeep and care, whatever the case may be. So in essence, it's simply the opportunity for the court to order that an individual or someone oversees an entity, be it a real estate entity or a business or that sort of thing. And the legislation that we're bringing makes very few substantive changes to the law of receivership, and I will let the two gentlemen here with me probably deal with this more in depth than I am going to. Suffice it to say that the law of receivership has been spread throughout the Minnesota statutes, and therefore it's very confusing. It's a little difficult for practitioners to know exactly how the pieces all fit together. And any time it is difficult to ascertain how the pieces fit together in law, you end up with disputes and litigation, and that drives the cost of the system up for everybody. So really, the purpose of this legislation is simply to try to bring a lot of these disparate kinds of provisions dealing with receivership together into one place to make it easier for practitioners, regardless of which side of the issue they may happen to be on, to deal with things, and that is really what this is doing. Now, I would ask at this point that Senator Newman's file be taken off the table, and if that is necessary, how do you want to go about this? I have an A1 amendment.
Senator Thompson,
to incorporate them.
Senator Thompson, just move the A1 amendment as an author's amendment because it's identical to the bill that Senator Newman just described.
Okay, thank you.
It's
all right, members.
A1 amendment. Oh, with one change, and perhaps counsel can explain the one difference.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, the other thing it does is delete a section that's in the House file that actually is unrelated to the underlying bill, but it was added on the House floor last session and was enacted somewhere else. So it just takes a section out of the bill.
All right.
And then adds Senator Newman's bill. So.
All right, very good. Thank you. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will move the A1 amendment as an author's amendment.
Senator Thompson moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Thompson.
Very good. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Philip Kunkel, who will describe in much more detail than I did exactly what we're doing and allow the members to hear from him.
Mr. Kunkel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Philip Kunkel. I'm an attorney with Gray Plant, Moody, Moody, and Bennett, riding the I-94 circuit between the St. Cloud office and the Minneapolis office. So I don't quite know where I office sometimes.
You're a circuit lawyer.
Exactly. Have justice, will travel. And with me today is Kevin Dunleavy from Beisel and Dunleavy here in Minneapolis. I'm here on behalf of the business law section of the State Bar Association, and Kevin is with the real property section. Both of us were involved in this process. As indicated earlier, the bill before you is an attempt to pull together receivership law in Minnesota. And I think a good place to start is what the heck is a receiver and why do you need it? And we've talked about that a little bit already. Receivers are very common. They're a creature that was created in the Old English common law, which permitted the court to appoint a representative of the court to take control of property and administer it, preserve it, and keep it intact during the pendency of a court action. Commonly, receivers are used in the foreclosure of commercial real estate mortgages, so in a foreclosure of a shopping center, a warehouse, apartment buildings, and so on. Receivers are appointed to collect the rents, pay the taxes, maintain the premises, and so on. But receivers over the last several years have been used in a variety of other circumstances. Marriage dissolutions, where spouses can't agree on how property ought to be divided. Courts will occasionally appoint a receiver to take control of that marital property. In addition, in the case of a dissolution of a business entity, a corporation or a limited liability company, the statutes provide for the appointment of a receiver should the shareholders reach a deadlock and be unable to maintain the business operations during the dissolution process. And then probably most notoriously recently, receivers have been appointed in a variety of fraud cases. The Tom Petters case is a good example. Mr. Kelly has been appointed a receiver in that case and also a trustee in certain bankruptcies. The Bernie Madoff case in New York, a receiver was appointed to collect assets for the benefit of the defrauded parties. Receivership is not a substitute for bankruptcy. It's instead viewed as an option to preserve property. Now, why do we think, and why do this group of lawyers think that we need, you know, a comprehensive bill? When we first started looking at this, we did what everybody does these days. We did a Google search of the Minnesota statutes and learned that there were 299 references to receivers throughout the Minnesota statutes. In many of those statutes, the statute simply said, and in this circumstance, a receiver can be appointed. But there is no law, there's no statute to guide the court in determining who could be the receiver, what the receiver's powers were, what the receiver's duties were. So in that case, there was just simply no guidance. As a result, the law regarding receiverships in Minnesota has grown up on somewhat of an ad hoc basis and not particularly transparent. While there's a court rule that addresses some of the responsibilities of a receiver, that court rule, Rule 137, generally wasn't followed, and the court had discretion to amend or to not require compliance with that rule. So what Mr. Dunleavy will explain in a little more detail what's in the bill, but essentially the attempt here is to bring the existing law regarding receivers into one location and perhaps enhance that law somewhat, but in general, the goal and the objective here is to clarify this law, make it more transparent, and hopefully avoid litigation in those cases. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Dunleavy.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Dunleavy.
Mr. Chair, it's a pleasure to be back. And the committee has seen me oftentimes in the past on real property section bills, and so I'm here because of my interest in the mortgage foreclosure receiverships. And I've been told that my presentations are a little dry, so I'm going to try to add a little water to my presentation today. I don't know how that'll work, but I'm going to give it a shot.
I've never heard that, Mr. Dunleavy.
Okay, first I'm going to talk a little bit about the drafting process. This is an MSBA bill, and there were two sections of the Bar Association that worked on this bill. Phil is in the business law section, but he's also noted to be knowledgeable about real estate, and I'm a real estate attorney. I'm in the real property section. So this bill went through both of those sections, was reviewed by the sections, and then was approved. Then it went to the full Bar Association, and the full Bar Association has a legislative committee, and that committee also approved this. Then it was at the House of Delegates, and then finally it got... Once it was finally approved by the Bar Association, that's when the Bar Association lobbyists would look for sponsors. But before all that happened, there was a committee of about two dozen attorneys, including Phil and I, and we met about 18 times, probably more than 60 hours of meetings. And with all the attorneys, there was about 16 or 17,000 billable hours, which is way more than I do in a whole year. And maybe in about 10 years or more. But
Mr. Dunleavy, not being an attorney myself, I'm getting real nervous.
So what we did, though, is we didn't try to come up with this on our own. We do what lawyers like to do, and we try to recycle something that somebody had already done so we don't have to reinvent the wheel. So we took Washington statutes. There were some law review treatises and so on that gave us the feeling that there was the Washington statutes had been well thought out and well drafted by the Washington legislature. Now, to look specifically at the bill, Chapter 576 establishes grounds for appointments of receiver, sets forth the qualifications and the bond. In my experience, I've gotten receivers in the past in mortgage fraud situations or real estate fraud situations, and also when I'm foreclosing on income property like apartment buildings or office towers and things like that. I've got a receiver on five buildings in Osseo right now that I'm foreclosing, and in that case, because we don't have the statute on the books now, I had to go to court several times. There were at least two hearings, and there were hours of negotiations between the attorneys before we could get to an order in a relatively simple mortgage foreclosure situation. So what we're hoping that this will do is make it so that there's less attorney time, less court time that's being taken up by the lack of guidance from the legislature on receiverships. The receivership gives notice to all the creditors. There's two types of receivers. There's limited and general. Limited receivers can't sell the property. So, for example, if there's a mortgage foreclosure receiver, that would be a limited receiver. They can just collect the rents. If it's a business fraud situation like the Petter situation, they would typically have the power to sell things. They can also hire attorneys and accountants. They can hire property managers. They can list property for sale, do all the kinds of things that an owner would do if they're a general receiver, provide for utility service, get financing. And so generally they operate the business as though they're the owner if it's a general receiver. And if it's a mortgage receiver, it just collects the rent. Then the assignment for benefit of creditors, that's Chapter 577. That's a voluntary process that there is an assignment for benefit of creditors on the books now, but it doesn't work, and so it's never used. What assignment for benefit of creditors is, I'm the debtor, and the bank and I recognize that the business is failing. I'm gonna assign my property to somebody to liquidate it, and then the person that liquidates the property would distribute the money to the creditors. And so what that does is it makes it a quicker process. It's a voluntary process, and so it's not, a debtor wouldn't do it unless they want to do it. A creditor doesn't have to do it unless they want to do it. But it's in everybody's interest to liquidate quickly and distribute the money. And so that's the philosophy behind assignment for benefit of creditors. Thank you.
Any further questions? Hearing none, Senator Thompson renews his motion that House File 382, as amended, be recommended to pass and proceed to the floor of the Senate.
So moved.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Thompson.
Thanks, guys.
Members, our next meeting on Tuesday will be covering the confirmation discussion with Commissioner Roy and
Lindsay.
Commissioner Lindsay on Tuesday. So we'll be wanting to advance to that quickly at the beginning of the session. There's no further business before the committee. Meeting's adjourned.